Chapter 64. The strong westerly winds finally began to abate, reducing the seas to a moderate chop. The settling wind brought with it a wispy gray fog that was common to the region during the spring and summer months. The thermometer finally climbed into double digits, prompting shipboard jokes about the balmy weather. Pitt was just thankful that the weather had calmed enough to launch the submersible without risk. Climbing through the hatch of the Bloodhound, he settled into the pilot's seat and began checking a bank of power gauges. Beside him, in the co-pilot's seat, Giordino reviewed a pre-dive checklist. Both men wore just light sweaters. Shivering in the cold cabin, they knew would soon turn toasty from the myriad electrical equipment aboard. Pitt looked up as Jack Dahlgren stuck his poker face into the hatch. "You boys remember, those batteries don't hold their charge so well in this cold weather. Now you go bring me back the ship's bell, and I might just leave the lights on for you."
"You leave the lights on, and I just might let you keep your job," Giordino uttered back.
Dahlgren smiled and started humming the Merle Haggard standard, "Okie from Muskogee," then closed and sealed the hatch. A few minutes later, he worked the controls of a small crane, lifting the submersible off the deck and depositing it in the center of the ship's brightly illuminated moon pool. Inside, Pitt signaled for its release, and the yellow cigar-shaped submersible began its descent. The seafloor was just over 1,000 feet deep, and it took the slowly drifting Bloodhound almost 15 minutes to reach to the bottom. The gray-green waters quickly melded to black outside the submersible's large viewing port, but Pitt waited until they passed the 800-foot mark before powering up the bright bank of exterior high-intensity lights. Rubbing his hands together in the slowly warming cabin, Giordino looked at Pitt with mock suffering.
"Did I ever tell you that I'm allergic to the cold?" he asked.
"At least 1,000 times.
My mama's thick Italian blood just doesn't flow right in these icebox conditions."
"I'd say the flow of your blood has more to do with your affinity for cigars and pepperoni pizzas than with your mother."
Giordino gave him a thankful look for the reminder and pulled the stubby remains of an unlit cigar out of his pocket and slid it between his teeth. Then he retrieved a copy of the shipwreck's sonar image and spread it across his lap.
"What's our plan of attack once we reach the wreck site?"
"I figure we have 3 objectives, Pitt replied, having earlier planned the dive. "First and most obvious is to try and identify the wreck. We know that the Erebus had a role in the ruthenium that was obtained by the Inuit. We don't know if the same holds true for the Terror. If the wreck is the Terror, there may well be no clues whatsoever aboard. The second objective is to penetrate the hold and determine if there are any significant quantities of the mineral still there. The third objective is the most tenuous. That would be to search the great cabin and the captain's cabin to determine if the ship's log still exists."
"You're right," Giordino agreed. "The log of the Erebus would be the Holy Grail. It surely would tell us where the ruthenium was found.
Sounds like a long shot to hope that it survived intact, though."
"Admittedly, but far from impossible.
The log was probably a heavy leather-bound book stored in a chest or locker. In these cold waters, there's at least a chance it's still in one piece. Then it would be up to the preservationists to determine if it could be conserved and ultimately deciphered."
Giordino eyed the depth gauge.
"We're coming up on 950 feet.
"Adjusting for neutral buoyancy," Pitt replied, regulating the submersible's variable ballast tank. Their descent slowed to a crawl as they passed the 1,000-foot mark, and minutes later, a flat, rocky seafloor appeared beneath them. Pitt engaged the propulsion controls and drove the vessel forward, skimming a few feet off the bottom. The craggy brown seafloor was mostly devoid of life, a cold and empty world not far removed from the frozen lands protruding above the surface. Pitt turned the submersible into the current, guiding the vessel in a sweeping series of S-turns. Though the narwhal had been stationed directly above the wreck, Pitt knew that they had drifted considerably south during their descent. Giordino was the first to spot the wreck, pointing out a dark shadow on their starboard flank. Pitt steered the Bloodhound hard to the right until the stately wreck materialized under their spotlights. Before them sat a fully intact 19th-century wooden sailing ship.
It was one of the most remarkable shipwrecks Pitt had ever seen. The frigid Arctic waters had retained the ship's condition in a near-perfect state of preservation. Covered in a fine layer of silt, the ship appeared fully intact, from its bowsprit to its rudder. Only the masts, which had slipped from the deck during the long plunge to the bottom, lay out of place, dangling over the side railing. Mired in its desolate eternal mooring, the ancient ship exuded a forlorn aura. To Pitt, the ship appeared like a tomb in an empty graveyard. He felt an odd chill thinking about the men who had sailed her, then been forced to abandon their home of 3 years under desperate conditions. Slowly engaging the submersible, Pitt cruised in a tight arc around the vessel while Giordino activated a forward-mounted video camera. The hull timbers still appeared thick and sound, and in places where the silt was thin, they could see a coat of black paint still adhering to the wood. As they rounded the stern, Giordino was startled to see the tips of a propeller protruding from the sand. "They had steam power?" he asked. "A supplement to sail once they reached the ice pack," Pitt confirmed. Both ships were equipped with coal-fired locomotive engines installed for added propulsion through the thinner sea ice. The steam engines were also used to provide heat for the ship's interior. No wonder Franklin had the confidence to try to plow through Victoria Strait in late summer. What he may not have had enough of by that point in the expedition was coal. Some figure they ran short of their coal supplies, and that may have accounted for the ship's becoming trapped in the ice. Pitt pushed the submersible around to the ship's port side, anxious to find lettering on the bow that might reveal the ship's name. But he was disappointed to find instead the only real evidence of damage to the ship. The hull beneath the bow was blown out in a jagged mass of timbers caused by the constricting ice. The damage had extended to the topside deck when the weakened section had struck the seafloor, causing the timbers above to buckle. A broad section of the bow on both sides of the center line had crumpled like an accordion just a few feet astern of the vessel's blunt prow. Pitt patiently hovered off both sides of the bow as Giordino brushed aside the silt with an articulated arm, but no identifying script work could be found. "I guess this one wants to play hard to get," Pitt muttered. "Like too many of the women I've dated," Giordino grimaced. "I guess we'll have to take Dahlgren up on his ship's bell offer after all." Pitt elevated the submersible above the deck, then swept toward the stern. The deck was remarkably clear of debris, the ship obviously configured in its winter hibernation mode when it was abandoned. The only unusual item was a large canvas structure that lay across the deck amidships. Pitt knew from the historical accounts that a tent-like covered structure was set up on the deck in winter so that the crew could escape the interior confines of the ship for exercise. Pitt continued aft, where he found the helmsman's station and the large wooden ship's wheel, still standing upright and attached to the rudder. A small bell was mounted nearby, but after careful scrutiny, he could find no markings on it. "I know where the ship's bell is," Pitt stated, cruising back toward the bow. Hovering over the tangled mass of timbers and debris where the bow had buckled, he pointed down. "It's in the garbage pit here." "Must be," Giordino agreed with a nod. "It's not our day. Or night." He checked a console of dials in front of him. "We have just under 4 hours of battery power remaining. Do you want to rummage around for the bell or have a look inside?" "Let's take Rover for a walk. There's one upside to this damage, I suppose. It will allow us easier access to the interior." Pitt edged the Bloodhound to a clear section of the deck, then carefully set the submersible down. When the ship's timbers gave no indication of stress, he powered off the propulsion motors. In the co-pilot seat, Giordino was busy engaging another device. Tucked between the submersible's support skids was a small tethered ROV the size of a small suitcase. Equipped with a micro-sized video camera and small array of lights, it could maneuver into the smallest corners of the shipwreck. Jockeying a controlling joystick, Giordino guided the rover out from its cradle and toward the open section of the deck. Pitt flipped down an overhead monitor, which displayed the live video feed from the device. Methodically weaving above and around the debris, Giordino finally found a large gap in the deck and guided the ROV into the bowels of the ship. Pitt unrolled a cutaway diagram of the Erebus and tried to track the ROV's location as it moved beneath the main deck. The ship had two levels below decks, plus a dank hold where the engine, boiler, and coal reserves were housed below the waterline. The living and dining areas for both crew and officers were located on the lower deck, one level down from the main deck. Beneath the lower deck was the orlop deck, which was strictly a storage area for provisions, tools, and ship's spares. "You should be dropping near the galley," Pitt remarked. "It's adjacent to the crew's living quarters, which is a sizable compartment." Giordino guided the rover down until the deck came into view, then he turned and panned the bay. The still water inside the ship was exceedingly translucent, providing perfectly clear visibility. Pitt and Giordino could see, not 5 feet away from the ROV, the galley's large cook stove, built up on a layer of bricks. It was a massive structure made of cast iron and crowned by 6 large burners on its flat cooking surface. Sitting atop it were several black iron pots of varying sizes. "One galley as ordered," Giordino remarked. He then steered the ROV aft, slowly scanning back and forth. The thin bulkhead surrounding the galley had fallen to the deck, revealing the open crew's quarters. The bay was mostly empty of debris, save for a large number of planked wooden slabs that lay evenly spaced across the deck. "Mess tables," Pitt explained as the rover's cameras focused in on one of the tabletops. They were stowed overhead to make way for the crew's hammocks, but lowered on ropes at mealtimes. They've fallen to the deck as the ropes deteriorated. The ROV moved aft as the compartment narrowed until fronting a wide bulkhead. "That will be the main hatchway," Pitt explained. "Keep moving aft and we should reach a ladderway that descends to the orlop deck. They covered it with an enclosure to keep out the draft from below, but we'll have to hope it was dislodged when the ship sank." Giordino steered the ROV around the hatchway, then brought it to a sudden halt. Tilting it toward the deck, the camera revealed a large circular hole cut through the deck. "No door here," he said. "Of course we can drop through the deck collar," Pitt replied. The deck collar held one of the ship's 3 masts as it ran down to the hold. When the masts pulled free during the sinking, they left an open passageway into the lowest depths of the ship. The rover squeezed through the opening, then sprayed its lights on the black orlop deck. For the next 50 minutes, the ROV scoured the corners of the deck, Giordino methodically searching for possible traces of the ore. But all they found was a vast supply of tools, weapons, and the ship's stowed canvas sails that would never feel a sea breeze again. Returning to the mast stand, they delved into the lower hold, finding only a few scraps of coal near the massive steam boiler. Coming up empty on both levels, Giordino began threading the ROV back up to the lower deck when the submersible's radio crackled. "Narwhal the Bloodhound, have you got your ears on?" came the readily distinguishable voice of Jack Dahlgren. "Bloodhound here. Go ahead, Jack," Pitt replied. "The captain wanted me to let you know that our friend with the barge has moseyed back onto the radar screen. Appears to be sitting stationary about 10 miles north of us."
"Affirmative. Please keep us advised."
"Will do. You boys having any luck down there?"
"We sure are, but it has all been bad. We've got Rover on the leash and are about to try for the captain's cabin."
"How are you doing on power?"
Pitt eyed a bank of dials and meters overhead. "We're good for another 90 minutes on the bottom, and we'll probably need it all."
"Roger. We'll look for you up top in less than 2. Narwhal out."
Pitt stared at the dark abyss beyond the submersible, contemplating the icebreaker on the surface above. Were they, in fact, monitoring the narwhal? His gut told him so with certainty. It wouldn't be his first encounter with the forces of Mitchell Goyette, he now knew. And what of Clay Zack? Could it be possible that Goyette's thug was aboard the icebreaker? Giordino nudged him back to the task at hand.
"Ready to move aft."
"The clock is ticking," Pitt said quietly. "Let's get it done."